Well, I appreciate those kind words of introduction. It was 23 years ago when we bought property here, originally intended as a second home, and then that didn't last long and became our regular home. We've enjoyed this congregation so much. We appreciate you. But I also understand that in American life, 23 years is just slightly shorter than eternity, and that many of you came to this congregation after we had left. I've been 16 years at Freed Hardeman. The first year I was there, one of my students said that I reminded her of her grandfather. And my response to that was, what? I mean, it always works out as a compliment, almost always anyway, when people say that you remind them of their parents or their grandparents. But grandparents, I mean, what do I remind them of now? Like Moses or... I've enjoyed teaching at Freed Hardeman very, very much. My wife and I believe very strongly in the school and in its opportunity to do good in the lives of young people. I have taught all my adult life, indeed, since before I was an adult. I started teaching the adult class in church 56 years ago. And coming to Freed Hardeman has certainly caused me to think more about teaching as such. You never know, right? I'm accustomed to people ignoring me. Right? It's one thing that preachers and lawyers have in common, right? If you say something that people don't want to hear, well, they don't hear it too well. You never can tell when people might be listening. When they might actually pay attention to what you're saying and do something in accordance with it. And this summer, as you consider the way in which Jesus is teaching, not just the substance of each of the parables, but the fact that he chose to teach in parables, I would encourage you to think about what can be properly reasoned from that choice. Every teacher, it's one of those things that sometimes you wish were not true, but whether you like it or not, it is always true that every teacher, every single time that they get up and teaching about the Bible, is teaching three things. Right? They are teaching the particular passage, hopefully, that they have been asked to comment on. Not always is that the case. I've been on the lectureship committee that runs the Freed Hardeman lectures, or that sets them up, is a better term, better phrase, for all of those 16 years. And, hey, we have speakers sometimes that remind me of the introduction that Athens Clay Pullius, when he was president of Lipscomb, once gave Marshall Keble. I suspect to some of you those names mean nothing, but to some of you they mean a lot. Marshall Keble probably baptized more people in his lifetime than any other person in the 20th century, some 25,000 people. And Brother Pullius got up to introduce him at the 1949 lectureship and said, well, Brother Keble, his assigned topic is, he said, I'm not going to waste my time telling you what the assigned topic is because I know Brother Keble and he's going to talk on what he's going to talk on. So let her rip, right? Hopefully, though, you talk about what you've been asked to talk about, but you always teach on a more fundamental level, two other things you teach about how to teach the Bible. Right? I know, By this time in my life, I've had a couple of thousand students at Freed Heart. And I don't know what they'll remember from what I've said. Well, one of my classes, I'm told, I'm not on, somebody said something about Twitter. Forget it for me, right? I've never been on Facebook. Right? Why do I have a tie on? Right? Because I'm a dinosaur and I'm proud of it. And I demand the rights accorded dinosaurs. But I'm told that on social media, one of my students said that after covering a certain passage in Judges, the story of Eglon, and Ehud, that he had learned that the left-handed guy killed the fat guy. Well, what can I say? The left-handed guy did kill the fat guy. But I was not expecting that to be the highlight of the lesson. There'll be people who copy or influence in some way by the way that I teach the Bible, looking at totally different passages. And that's certainly true for me. Who most influenced my method of teaching? And the answer is somebody who wasn't a Bible teacher at all. He's my freshman English teacher. And he was famous in academia. He passed away very, very soon after I graduated. But unknown to the general public, but his freshman English teacher that had a great influence on him, his name would be known to you because his freshman English teacher was Robert Frost, a great poet. And my teacher said that reading was an act of love. You turned yourself off, right? And you listened as quietly as you could, as intently as you could, to exactly what somebody else had to say. And that teaching or writing about literature was also an act of love and respect. That if you thought that what you were writing about, if you thought Shakespeare was fine, then you wanted to write in a manner worthy of it. And you take those principles and apply them to the Bible, and they're pretty strong principles. Can we quiet ourselves? Listen to exactly what God has to say. And when we respond in a fashion worthy of what God has to say. Paul, four times in his letters, uses expressions that are almost syntactically identical in Greek, saying to live or be a citizen or act in a fashion worthy of the gospel. When we teach, are we going to teach in that way? And the other thing that we always teach, whether we like it or not, is something about our understanding of the nature of Christianity. Most of the teachers, most of the people that I have known in my life, I was challenged by it, thinking through in this last year. I had plenty of time to think. I've had reason to think. I had the coronavirus right last summer and was very sick. And even before that, right, I had a local neurologist in Jackson, Tennessee. Tell me I was dying. I had a rare disease of the brain that would kill me. It was really encouraging. And the Mayo Clinic begs to disagree, which I'm glad is true. But never being told that you're dying, it is thought-provoking. Right. what are we about? What is this business of Christianity? And when I think about the people who have impacted my life, you know that often I can't remember a single thing that they ever said. I don't remember any detail. I remember who they were, not what they said. And so we, when we teach, right, need to understand that often that will be what people take away. Let's read from Matthew chapter 13, verses 10 through 17. It comes right in the middle between Jesus' parable of the sower and his explanation of the parable of the sower. And the disciples came and said to him, "Why do you speak to them in parables?" And he, answering, said to them, "Because it is given to you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but it is not given to them. Or whoever has, it shall be given to him, and he shall abound. But whoever does not have, even that which he has, will be taken from him. For this reason, I speak in parables to them, because seeing they do not see, and hearing they do not hear, nor understand. And the prophecy of Isaiah that says, the prophecy is fulfilled for them that says, you will surely hear and not understand, and surely see and not behold. For the heart of this people has grown dull, and they hear with ears of heaviness, and they shut their eyes, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with the heart and turn, and I should heal them. But blessed are your eyes because they see, and your ears because they hear. For truly I say to you that many prophets and righteous men desired to see what you see and did not see it, and hear what you hear and did not hear it." When I teach the life of Christ, I often ask my students, you know, professors love trick questions, or questions that they know or anticipate will get the wrong answer for the first time. Occasionally you have some student who ruins everything by giving the right answer right off the bat. But I'll ask my students, why did Jesus teach in parables? Why did Jesus say that he taught in parables? And you can usually count on people to say, well, so that the common people could understand the gospel. And that's the wrong answer to the question, at least as I phrased it the second time. Right? It's the right answer, is the part of the right answer as to why Jesus taught in parables. The word parable is a good Greek word. Comes from a verb that means ball, right? A ball. That to throw a ball alongside something. You create an image and you use that image to compare with another reality. And like the word metaphor, it's also a good Greek word. Parable is often described as an extended metaphor. Metaphor means literally to carry over. You've got something, and it provides a kind of pattern. And by using that pattern, you provide insight into the nature of something else. But what Jesus said was the purpose of teaching in parables, was to prevent people from understanding? Which people? Why would God intentionally confuse people? And the answer is, confusion is a good thing when it's a step in the right direction. Right? When people think that they've got it, but are wrong. And they have to be taken back to square one so that they can understand it as they really should. There were a great many people, I suppose, like Nicodemus. You ever thought about Nicodemus? Have you ever sympathized with him? Do you think after the conversation with Jesus recorded in John chapter 3 that Nicodemus didn't go home and say to his wife, "What?" Right? But Nicodemus, that's a teacher in Israel, right? He thinks I suspect that he was expecting Jesus to be so appreciative of his support, even though it was given in the middle of the night. Right? But Jesus says you must be born again. Are you a teacher of Israel and don't know these things? And the answer was yes to both of those things, right? He was a teacher of Israel and he didn't know those things. He had to learn. Every valley shall be exalted. And every mountain and hill made low. That's Isaiah 40. It's quoted in Luke 3, I think, by John the Baptist. It's one of the fundamental points in the gospel. That God resisteth the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Why do you have to show your work? We don't have the young people with us, but some of you like me. I was talking to, we have a class in the church where Becky and I belong in Henderson. It's called the Primetime Class, and a more accurate title would be the Geezer Class. I was saying to them that I didn't know their life history, and some of them had a lot of life history to know. All right, but many of us probably can remember dimly a time when we went to school and we had to show not just the answer, but how we got the answer. Why? And the reason is because how you get the answer matters. Young preacher asked me once whether when Paul says, and he says in different wording, but essentially the same basic idea a number of times, maybe half a dozen times, something along the lines that we have the mind of Christ. And the young preacher asked me, does that mean that we come to the same conclusions as Christ came to? Or does it mean that we think like Christ? And the answer to that either-or question, like most really good either-or questions, was yes. Right? It means both things. I will not go to heaven. See, if heaven is a place where I'm going to be happy eternally, and not just a way to avoid hell, then I need to belong there. I don't need to subscribe to some list of conclusions so that they'll let me in the door. My character needs to have changed so that I can say it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. If Christ lives in me, then my living in Him is going to be natural. But if He doesn't live in me, nothing can substitute for that. And so Jesus chooses to teach by parables is a very powerful powerful indication of two things. It's a powerful indication of the nature of the Christian message. And it's a powerful indication of the nature of the Christian life. Let's talk about the Christian message first. It's simple. Now, I spent a lot of time learning Greek in my lifetime. And I've learned Hebrew too. Somebody asked me, did I like Hebrew? And I said, I like Hebrew so much that I've learned it three times. Right? I learned it, didn't use it, forgot it, had to learn it again, didn't use it, forgot it, learned it. Okay, I've spent thousands of hours in my lifetime reading Greek. This summer I've been reading Aristophanes. And you know what the easiest Greek surviving from the ancient world is? It's this. Many a Greek student has gotten to the point where they can read the Greek New Testament and say, "Ah, I know Greek." No, you don't. You got third grade reading level Greek. That's great. Right? But God's message is simple. How about alternative gospels? You know, occasionally there'll be some kind of academic paper or you will see something in the news. Man, don't you long for the days when if you saw something in the news, it might actually be news? But you see some report about there being, these other gospels that talk about Christ that the church suppressed. No. No, to take a look at those. Somebody said a long time ago, and it's absolutely good advice, said if you worry about alternative gospels, read one of them. It'll cure you. Right? They're products of a second century movement called Gnosticism. That is, people who thought that knowing was what God wanted from you. God loves intellectuals. And those so-called gospels aren't gospels. They're a mess. They say nothing about everyday life. They use language that's far from the vocabulary of the everyday person of the second century AD. The real gospels, right, are pitched for the common people. Think of the passages. What does God want from us? Right? And there are a whole bunch of passages that suggest that what God wants from us is not difficult. Right? He has showed thee, O man, what is good. And what doth the Lord require of thee? But to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. Those words are from Micah chapter 6, verse 8. You want a happy life? Think about Psalm 34. It's quoted in 1 Peter 3, 10 and 11. Right? The one who wishes to have a good life, to see good days. Let him refrain his tongue from evil, right? And his lips from speaking deceit. It's easy. It's easy to understand, right? It's not easy to do. That's the problem. Why do people not get things right? When I first started teaching, would I be 21 again? Oh, only with a host of conditions. But in some ways, I envy that 21-year-old. Because the 21-year-old, Jim Gardner, thought that if people were wrong, it was because they just didn't understand. A little more information. A little encouragement, and they'd come right. It's not true. It's not true. It's not true of any of us. I'm not saying something that I've learned about other people. I'm saying something I've learned about people, including me. Why do people not accept the truth? This is the condemnation, that light has come into the world. And men, men love darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. A couple of chapters later, that's of course from John chapter 3. A couple of chapters later, Jesus says, "How can you believe? You who receive glory from each other and do not seek the glory, the honor that comes from God." Christian message is simple. It doesn't require expertise. It requires humility. I wish I could claim right, that all those hours spent in Greek had produced some more fruit than they have. I suppose that the single greatest good in my life from having learned Greek is to be able to say to people who make complicated arguments from Greek, and I've learned, again, through the lectureship, that the tendency to argue from Greek is inversely proportional to one's knowledge of it. Right? But agape. Don't worry about agape. Love people. The English will do it. It'll do it. Ekklesia. The called out. You know that ekklesia is the Greek word used for the mob in Ephesus that nearly kills Paul. It means the gathering together. The assembly. You want to be a part of the ekklesia of a come to church. That's what that means. It's simple. It doesn't require expertise. It does require us to have the attitude expressed in Deuteronomy 8, quoted by Jesus to Satan when he tempts him, that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. A person who had the greatest influence on my family at one remove, on my mother and my uncle, was a man named S.H. Hall. He was a longtime preacher for Russell Street in Nashville, a congregation that I think no longer exists, but in its day was one of the largest congregations in the country. And he was chairman of the board of trustees of Lipscomb and described by his enemies as the Pope of Nashville. But Brother Hall, preaching on the passage, "Live by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God," used it to talk about giving in the church, contribution. Boy, he wouldn't last as a local preacher these days, but he is exactly right, right? To talk about living by every word that proceeds from God as an abstraction is meaningless. The question is, when you actually face a question of practical impact, what am I going to do? Are you going to listen to what God has to say and do it? And another point that's suggested about the nature of the Christian message is that it is about everyday life. The reason why the parables can work is because the things that are thrown along beside, right, actually correspond to the things about which they teach. I don't know how many of you have read a commentary written in the last 30 years. Certainly by somebody, this is occasionally, alas, true by people writing who are members of the church, but it's particularly true of so-called Protestant scholarship. It's less true, actually, in Catholic scholarship. But you tried to read a commentary. I bought a book, a commentary on Judges, once from my very dear friend, a person I greatly admire, Clyde Woods, who taught at Freed Hardeman. I think Abraham was one of his first students. And I took it with me on a mission trip to Romania. Right? And I'm there and I don't have a whole bunch of books, and so I keep coming back to it, trying to find something in it that might actually be worth. And I told him that the highest and best use of that commentary was to start campfires. It was awful, right? Because it wasn't about the message of Judges. There's an old joke about Moses Lard that some of you may remember, that a farmer is struggling with the book of Romans, and he asks a preacher to recommend a commentary, and the preacher recommends Moses Lard's commentary and gives him the commentary, and the farmer comes back 3 weeks later and hands back the commentary, and the preacher says, well, how about it? How'd you like it? And he said, well, I think Romans throws a lot of light on Lard. Right? Look at what people who think of themselves in a pretentious way as scholars say and write about the gospel and compare it to the way Jesus teaches. And they're almost incomparable, right? They're different worlds. And that ought not to be the case. Now, not only, and I know I need to move much more quickly, but not only does the teaching of parables say something about the way the gospel message is conveyed, right? About how Christian teaching ought to be conducted, but also about the nature of Christian life. And I think that the single most important point that I could make about that is that Christianity is about real things, right? Not a bunch of meaningless words. In 1985, I graduated from law school, and our oldest daughter, like 3 days before my graduation, was feeling in her stomach and felt a sudden big lump, and it was a tumor on her liver, the size of a softball. I had to, it turned out to be benign. And, you know, she lived, still lives, never came back. But that summer, we didn't have two nickels to rub together. People look at my resume and they think, well, he's a person born with a silver spoon in his mouth. No. Right? My father's an alcoholic. I grew up in La Follette. He died when I was a boy and left us nothing. I had to go to work. And sitting in church, listening to someone preach and say nothing, nothing, no matter how well it was said, was not acceptable to me. And I made the promise to myself then, and I've tried to keep it, that I would never, not a single time in my life, would I ever again stand up to fill the time, to say, to go through and give a lesson that didn't teach. Now, I may have failed to teach, but I haven't failed to try. And it's so easy to substitute the illusion of faith for the reality. Right, James chapter 2, right? You go, you pass a poor person and you say, oh, be you warmed and filled. I'm a Christian, I believe. Oh, let's have good sermons about grace. Do I believe in grace? You bet I do. I hope it exists because I can't go to heaven without it. Does God love me? Yes, He does. Does He love you? Yes. Does He love the people who will be lost? Yes. And so I need to say something more to those people than that God loves them. We can't do away with the offense of the cross. In 1 John 4, right? You say you love God. Well, all right, do you love people? Because if you say you love God but you don't love people, you're lying. And it may not be that you're consciously lying. The most dangerous lies are the ones that we tell ourselves. We say we love God. The acid test, though, is how do we act in real life? And the parables are our reminder, right, that it's about that reality. It isn't words. And that the real life works the same way, whether physically or spiritually. And I would say that the strongest example that I can give in today's world is so-called postmodernism. Now, there's no objective reality. I'm going to fly in a couple of weeks, and I'm counting on not having a postmodernist pilot. Right, I'm counting on the engineers at Boeing not being postmodernist engineers. I had a medical procedure yesterday. I'm counting on my doctors not being postmodernist doctors. We know that's nonsense. In every area of life where there has to be a reckoning, people in religion and politics and sociology say things that if they thought about them in the context of everyday life, they'd know they were crazy. Right? Of course, there's a right and wrong. Of course, actions produce results, and different actions produce different results. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. You can't make fun of God. You can't fool Him. Whatever a man sows, that shall he also reap. People talk about Christianity and saying that, when I die, God's going to look at me and He's not going to see me, He's going to see Jesus. There's a sense in which that's true, but man, as C.H. Spurgeon said 150 years ago, nobody ever went to heaven incognito. You're not going to sneak in. God knows who you are. And so we better know who we are. Face who we are. And if we're not who we ought to be, we need to change. It's not something we can do by ourselves. That's where grace comes in. But facing reality, that's this consistent theme in the parables. And facing reality over time. The great agricultural parables of Jesus certainly illustrate this point. I did run a marathon again this spring. Now, I ran a laughable marathon. I finished first in my age group. I also finished last in my age group because I was the only person in my age group crazy enough to run that marathon. Right? I was the tail of the dog. How many miles do you need to run that marathon? You realize that marathon running? People talk about, oh, you ran 26 miles. That's not the challenge. That's the payoff. I ran 600 miles this spring. I can't, when I practice law, don't worry, I'm a recovering lawyer. But I learned to do certain things. Did I learn in a day or a year? I represented at one time or another every major mining company in the United States and most of the major energy companies. And I think I knew what I was doing eventually. But it took a huge amount of effort. Would it really be easier, do you think? Do you really think it would be easier to become like Jesus of Nazareth than it is to become a good lawyer? I doubt it. I think the parables tell me that you have to have the right seed, but you have to do an awful... Everybody wants to reap, and people don't want to sow and weed and cultivate. Now I'll close. In the lectureship this year, because of the coronavirus, we had intended to have a lectureship on the Gospel of Luke. We postponed that till next year. And mark your calendars, right? It's always the first week in February. It's the week of terrible weather in February is when the Free Hartman lectures occur. But instead, we did a short lectureship online about Ecclesiastes. And my assignment was the passage in Ecclesiastes 11 talking about uncertainty. Cast your bread upon the waters. And what the parables teach us is this uncertainty about human life, the frailty, right? The not knowing when the master is going to come back. We're not in management. We're workers in the vineyard. That's uncertain. What's not uncertain, what's absolutely certain, is that he's coming back. And there'll be a reckoning. Whether he comes back before I go to him, I don't know. But I know that either I will go to him or he will come to me. And I must live my life in accordance with that truth. Now, what I've said, I hope, what I've tried to do almost always in my teaching was there's a certain center of gravity in life, right? There are things that are important and things that are not important. And as I've gotten older, I've had less and less time for the things that aren't important. Because I feel the pressure of needing to address the things that are important. If you are not truly living the life that you know I think that almost every person that I have known in life, in their heart of hearts, no matter what lie they told others or told themselves, almost every person I've ever known knew in their heart of hearts whether their life was in union with the life of Christ. If yours is not, if you're not a Christian, you need to become one. And if you're a Christian but not a Christian, right, not following Christ with all your heart, you need to make that right. And we offer you the opportunity to respond as we stand and sing.